Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. March 7th, 2024, the dismal Biden polls edition. I'm David Plotz of CityCast.
I don't think titles should have the word dismal in them.
Chuckling and then criticizing. Chuckling is John Dickerson of CBS Primetime in New York City. Hello, John.
Chuckling Dickerson. That's one of the possible names for my theater review.
And criticizing, hectoring, the Amy Coney Barrett of this podcast, apparently. You're tone policing me already.
Stridency, David. Stridency is out.
Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School in New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
This week on the Gabfest, Trump and Biden all but clinched their nominations on Tuesday night, and Trump has a healthy lead in the polls going into November. What can Biden do about that? Then the Supreme Court prevents states from barring Trump from the presidential ballot, but bitterly disagreed about why they were doing that. And then The Atlantic's Frank Foer joins us to discuss whether the golden age for American Jews has come to an end. Plus, of course, we will have cocktail chatter. And reminder, we have a live show coming up on Wednesday, March 27th at the Hamilton here in Washington, D.C. Tickets are at slate.com/gabfestlive. It's a wonderful venue. It'll be very close to the action. And we're expecting to have a great guest who hopefully we'll be able to announce. Not yet. It's going to be a live taping. It's our first live taping of the year. It's going to be right in the midst of some serious Trump trial action and as the campaign is sort of getting rolling. So please join us, slate.com/gabfestlive, to be at our live taping on Wednesday, March 27th at the Hamilton in Washington, D.C. Donald Trump all but clinched the Republican presidential nomination this week as he crushed Nikki Haley in the Super Tuesday primaries, and she withdrew as his last GOP opposition. But the bigger story of the week, it's the polls that are setting the stage for the Biden-Trump showdown in November. Notably, a poll by Emily's New York Times and Siena that showed Trump with a clear 48-43 lead over Biden. And very satisfying numbers for Trump across the board. Surging support for him from non-college educated minority voters. Strong support for women. He's splitting women 50-50 with Biden. And dismally low approval ratings for Biden and massive concern about Biden's age. So, Emily, these polls. So, we can put Super Tuesday on ice for a second. The polls seemed atrocious for Biden, Emily. Can he take solace from anything in it?
Well, I mean, the margins are relatively modest. They're within the realm of changing them. The campaign is just getting started, and a lot of people are low information about it. They haven't really focused on it. It is true that these are two very familiar candidates since the nation saw them run for president the last time. However, it is also very possible that as people focus more on the race and think more about the policy differences between the two candidates, as well as the age issue, and also remember what it's like to have Donald Trump like fully on center stage, that some of them will change their minds. I mean, I'm persuaded by this analysis that for people like us who are following every time the ball bounces, a lot of the issues and the contrast seem obvious. But I think for a lot of people who don't do that, it's not the case.
John, you were nodding there. On the one hand, you don't want to give too much weight to polls that are so far out from the election. On the other hand, if you look historically, polls, the general election polls taken at this distance, this number of atomic units from the election have tended to be pretty accurate. They pretty much reflect where the election ends up. So how do we look at it?
Yeah, I grab your warning to not take them as gospel about the final outcome, even though notwithstanding what you said, I mean, we are in a very different place. It's been since Benjamin Harrison versus Grover the Good, Grover Cleveland, that we've had a situation in which you had a former president running against a current president in the way this race is arranged. So we are in special territory. Donald Trump is also an extremely special candidate. We've never had a candidate running for office with as many people who used to work for him in top positions saying that he's unfit for the job, and so on and so forth. So I think those particularities make for what's going to be some possible unpredictability. Now, we may very well get to the election day and say, you know, what's been amazing is ever since the 7th of March, this has been a basically known race that's followed a very similar pattern. But I think the possibilities for expectations, basically the possibilities for anything happening, mean we should probably look at what voters are doing rather than the polls at the moment. But if you are in the Biden camp, obviously, and if you're a Democrat, there's a lot of reasons to be worried, both about what you see inside the polls and also what you see in the results from some states like Michigan and Minnesota. But Trump has got real things to worry about, too. I mean, his problem with suburban women voters and college-educated voters is vast, and he seems to be only good at making it worse by the things he says and the way he behaves. And to Emily's very important point, there's an asymmetry here about what people know about. First of all, it's now going to focus on this being the actual choice. America doesn't want this election, and it's going to get it good and hard. But the choice between the two will be brought front and center, and Donald Trump's his record and his behavior now will be something that voters will be paying or forced to pay more attention to. And then I think we'll have a clearer sense of the race.
Can we just dive into a few of these particular examples of where Biden might see concern? I take your point, John, that there's so much that can happen and that Trump is facing problems with different groups. But to me, what was remarkable was the bleed in minority voters for Biden and the bleed in women that after everyone has talked so much about abortion and Dobbs, that Trump is running neck and neck with Biden among women, and he's almost caught Biden among non-college educated minority voters. Emily, what do you make about those two particular nuggets within the polling data?
I mean, I agree with you that they are worrisome for Democrats. And I'm not sure how to explain the shift in women or the numbers about women right now, except that maybe some of these reproductive rights issues are not top of mind and they could come back. And I do think there has just been this wave of concern about Biden's age that must be seeping into the electorate. And that, I mean, I feel like I've said this, but everybody has an opinion about this. It's something that's so accessible. And especially if you are not following politics that closely and you're not confident about how to distinguish among people's policy views and it all seems kind of complicated and you're suspicious, here is something you can have a strong opinion about. Now, it may be that that will kind of wash out over time, especially if Biden does a good job performing. And I think the State of the Union is going to be some kind of indication of that this week. And then, you know, obviously going forward, there are going to be lots of more opportunities for him to be trying to command attention. I do think he needs to do that, that he needs to be out there creating a different impression about his age and his vigor.
You can't do enough cartwheels. I mean, the expectations they're raising for this State of the Union are donkey-dinky-donks. I mean, Jeff Zients, the chief of staff, is saying, you know, this is going to be, you're going to see a very energized president, which seems to me has two flaws. One, sets the expectations really high. He's going to have to moonwalk into the building and then do a handstand on a skateboard to get to the damn well of the house. So that's crazy. And then secondly, it buys into the idea that vigorous, energetic performance art is what the presidency is about. But it's both wrong. The president isn't a job of like pantomime acts of excitement. Secondly, it ain't the kind of presidency this president is running. My guess is that they're setting expectations like this to create attention for the moment. And then Biden's going to gig Trump and spend a lot of his time gigging Trump, baiting him, poking at him for the purposes of giving fodder to what I think is the strategy, essentially, is that Biden's going to have to assemble an anti-Trump coalition, not so much a pro-Biden coalition. Yes, he'll talk about all the things he's done. All of that stuff is great, but that's a hard rock to push up a hill, to bring out one of the many cliches. It is easier to poke at Donald Trump, make him do something, and then say, remember that? Remember that guy? And then basically do that from now until November.
But I mean, the irony, of course, is that actually, from my perspective, Biden has had a remarkably successful presidency. He's done a remarkably good job. The economy is in much better shape than any economy in the world. The foreign policy decisions he's made, to my mind, have been pretty brave and certainly, for the most part, correct. The investments that he's pushed to make in American infrastructure and in like the chips manufacturing have been all really smart. And so it's kind of sad and ironic that he has to run the same campaign he ran in 2020, an anti-Trump campaign. But it's going to be so much harder to do because, as we see from this polling data, people have amnesia about Trump. A lot of the voters who, younger voters just didn't experience Trump in the same way, or they don't remember. They may not remember if you're a new young voter. Whereas Biden and Biden's shortcomings are fresh in their mind. And it is a much different proposition to run an anti-Trump campaign in 2024 than it was to do it in 2020. And I wish Biden great success in it. We should note, by the way, that Biden is giving his State of the Union tonight. We're taping on Thursday mornings before we tape, but probably after you listen. So I would say that Biden either did a stupendous job changing expectations. What a remarkable performance in front of a, very lively House of Representatives filled with hecklers. Or what a series of stumbles that Biden made tonight. And the frailty in his voice and his inability to control the room really show his weakness as a candidate.
So, prepare for the takes.
Do you guys think that Democrats should hope that the media covers the hell out of Trump the way they did in 2016, or that they shouldn't cover the hell out of him? There's the theory, I guess the Biden theory, if you're running an anti-Trump campaign, presumably you want Trump to be extremely overexposed to the public, and you want every time someone turns on the TV, there's Trump saying something wacky.
But you don't want it to be kind of jokey and ironic the way it was in 2016, right? The kind of beginning to end coverage of the rallies that just made him seem like a performer and not a serious threat. Because, one thing I was thinking when you were talking about amnesia, it's not that long ago that Trump was president, but I wonder if for some people, all of the kind of doom that lots of social scientists, critics of Trump prophecy, they look back and they think like, well, we made it through that. Could 4 more years of Trump really be much worse? You can kind of shrug it off. And the answer is like, yes, it could be much worse. The man is hosting Viktor Orban, the semi-authoritarian prime minister of Hungary. But I feel like there's a connection here with the media coverage, which is if the media coverage is kind of sober, then that's one thing. But if it treats Trump as like the guy who hosted The Apprentice, that's another.
America and everyone seems to have forgotten that COVID happened. There's a very weird thing going on, which is our entire economic conversation kind of absence the idea that there was a massive global shock that took place and that changed the way we should think about the economy, both the economy during the Trump years and also the economy during the Biden years, and what it takes for a president to respond to a shock like COVID-19. And it's very weird. Some Republicans have been saying, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? I don't think that's a question they're going to want to ask in about 2 weeks, because one of the things about COVID, which had, there were many failures of people who thought they knew what they were talking about. But Trump's response to COVID was lackluster. And this is based on the, political scientists and healthcare experts who went back and looked at what happened. I mean, he did not marshal all of his forces as an organizational dynamo and businessman to attack the problem. In other words, it wasn't just the fact that he had the wrong solutions. He had no real battle plan for how to handle it. He misinformed the public about what was going on. He misread China thoroughly from the early on. So as a window into his behavior when faced with a crisis, which is all what a presidency is, his record on COVID is awful.
But John, the amnesia of the American public, it plays here absolutely, which is that people remember the masking mandates. They are experiencing, if you're a parent of a child in school, what the downstream effects of the learning loss. They're remembering, insofar as they do, Operation Warp Speed and the vaccines were, pretty successful. And they are feeling the inflation that was a byproduct of all of the sort of spillover effects of COVID, which then hit during the Biden years. And so like, it is true that Trump's may have mismanaged it, but I don't think that people are sitting here. They haven't done that form of keen analysis. They are mostly feeling all these other things, which benefit Trump rather than benefit Biden.
No, you're totally right. I get what I mean, I guess, is that two things. One, in the economic conversation, COVID still doesn't come up in an analysis of comparative economies. That, I think, still is true. But secondly, you're exactly right. But the first part of COVID doesn't come up. I would just argue
stop
that
the there. People, stop the.
Yeah. Stop. But I just, some of the analysis of Operation Warp Speed by experts would suggest that it happened despite Trump's efforts, not because of them.
Do you want to hear more from us after this episode? Emily today did not shake her head no. She just batted her eyes and looked away. You should stick around for our bonus segment on Slate Plus. Today, we have a really great episode. So before we got on today, we were talking to our researcher, Julie Hugin. And Julie does a lot of things. But one of the things she is she is an election judge in Colorado, which is a Colorado term for a poll worker. And she was talking about working the polls in Colorado on Super Tuesday. And it was just talking about sort of the details of what it's like to be a poll worker. And we were fascinated. And so we just said, Julie, why don't you come on and do a Slate Plus segment where we can talk to you and educate our listeners about what it means to be a poll worker these days. So that's going to be a great segment, but it's just for Slate Plus members. So if you are a Slate Plus member, thank you. You have given us so much support and you've helped us keep the Gabfest going for so many years. If you're not a Slate Plus member, please sign up. Consider it. You'll get bonus segments on the Gabfest and other Slate podcasts, special discounts on live shows. You won't hit the paywall on the Slate site. And much more. So if you're not a member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today. That's slate.com/GabFestPlus. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Emily, we all knew that the Supreme Court was going to keep Trump on the ballot, that these challenges were going to fail. Did the Supreme Court do it in a way that does the least damage to the nation or the most damage to the nation?
Kind of the most. I'll go with the most.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah, okay. The reasoning is so poor and it went so much further than it needed to, at least the majority opinion did. And I don't know, I found this very deflating to read because I just felt like what they were saying just didn't make sense on a level of basic logic. So to explain, at issue here is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which talks about being in some way disqualified from office because you're an insurrectionist. So the court does not want to actually decide whether Trump committed insurrection or not. There's like one sentence in the concurrence by the liberal justices about this. Otherwise, it doesn't appear. And they were looking for an off-ramp. They had a bunch available. The one that they picked was this idea that the states cannot enforce this part of the 14th Amendment on their own. And I guess it kind of makes sense just as like a sort of 30,000 foot matter of political science that in a federal election, you can't have like a patchwork of results from different states about whether a candidate's on the ballot. Except that we have that patchwork of results all the time because the states have different rules about third-party candidates and ballots, and they do all kinds of ballot policing. And the majority opinion, it's called a per curiam opinion because nobody signed it. They just like literally just don't address any of that. And they make it seem really obvious that as an historical matter, Congress, when it ratified this part of the 14th Amendment was really just only thinking about the Confederacy and the particular situation then, when in fact they used these general terms, insurrectionists. They didn't say Confederate insurrectionists. They didn't write an amendment that was just for that one moment in time. There are various other problems I could go on, but it just, it's a stance that just sort of doesn't it. I understand the politics of it completely, like as a political matter where the court does not want to get in the way of Donald Trump appearing on the ballot because they think that is a poor outcome for American democracy, because they think that Americans should decide at the ballot box. I get it. I get it completely. I share a lot of those concerns. But as a kind of legal matter of looking at this text by a bunch of people who talk all the time about how faithful they are to the original meaning of the text, it was really a failure.
So your issue is not particularly, it sounds like it's not really with the five justices who's had the majority of the majority opinion. It's
well, no,
it
is.
The court as a whole. But well, even the dissenting concurrence sort of makes the same conclusion. It just doesn't go as far as the majority opinion.
Yeah, I think that distinction matters, because what the majority opinion effectively does is say Congress has to jump through a bunch of hoops to enforce this clause, which, by the way, looks entirely self-executing, like the rest of the 14th Amendment, right? Congress doesn't have to pass laws so that we have equal protection and due process. Those principles exist without specific enforcement. Congress can enforce them. That's what Section 5 of the 14th Amendment is about. But it doesn't have to do anything in order for us to have those important rights. Okay. It is important, this distinction between the quote concurrence and the majority opinion, because the majority opinion kind of shuts the door on any future challenge to Donald Trump and who knows who else, because they're basically saying, oh, Congress, you've got to pass laws and it has to be specific and evidence-based, and we're going to be there judging whether it's congruent and proportional, having the final say. And it just turns what appears to be a self-executing clause of the Constitution into, it's gone. It just doesn't exist anymore as a protection against insurrectionists holding office. I don't think. It's just really hard to see, or the eventuality in which we would have actual enforcement of this provision seems so much further away than it does before this ruling.
If the amendments in the Constitution are self-executing, does the fact that Section 5 of the 14th Amendment vests Congress with the authority to adopt appropriate legislation to enforce the other parts of the amendment, does that make it a special amendment in which it because of that specific language, it doesn't assume that everything, that it's self-executing, and therefore things have to be adopted by Congress, which would be the argument for why something has to be adopted by Congress to enforce Section 3?
No, I don't think so, because when you look at the history of the 14th Amendment, okay, so what's going on? We've come out of the Civil War. The Southern states are putting themselves back together, and they are passing black codes. They're passing these laws that subjugate the newly freed former enslaved people. And Congress is concerned about that. And so they pass the 14th Amendment. They provide for equal protection and due process. What they're really doing is enlisting the apparatus of the federal government in enforcing those rights on the states, right? They're saying, like, the federal courts, federal agencies, like, we are here to make sure the Southern states don't do this. And then you can see Section 5, and lots of historians do, is part of that, as them saying, like, look, South, if you don't respect these rights that we've put in here, we can pass additional enforcement legislation. Now, all of that got gutted after Reconstruction, which is a huge problem that the Supreme Court is largely responsible for. But that's what the 14th Amendment was doing.
I mean, I certainly agree with you, Emily, that it's now a dead letter, because there'll never be a congressional finding, at least in the Congress we can imagine, there will never be a congressional finding to bar a candidate for insurrection. Like, that's just not going to happen, that you can imagine.
And Congress has a remedy of impeachment if it wanted to go down this road, right? Like, yeah.
Yeah. But I guess when one of the problems with Section 3, looking at it from a modern context, I completely agree with the criticism that says they've abandoned their original principles. They have decided this particular form of messiness is impermissible, but they allow all sorts of other forms of messiness, like because that's just the patchwork nature of our election system. And I agree. Yes, I agree that they have abandoned their original. On the other hand, Section 3 is a mess. Like, it doesn't appear to offer any clear way to disqualify somebody. Even if you said, you know, yes, they can be disqualified, the standards, it does feel like you could end up in a really difficult situation where some states are saying the standard is someone has to be convicted of something. Some states can say you can have an evidentiary finding in the hearing here. The state legislature could find it. It doesn't feel in the presidential election context that this is a particularly functional bit of constitutional right.
Yeah. So if you're a pragmatist, you don't care that much about original meaning. I think what you have available is a version of the off-ramp that the concurrence took, which is in the context of the presidency, which is basically a national event. We don't want the states mucking around. Now you have to like whistle past all the other ways in which states enforce ballot eligibility requirements. But just set that aside. You could just be like, you know what? I don't really care because I just think this is a bad outcome and it cannot be in this national context the way the Constitution should operate. I think basically Elena Kagan said that at oral argument. And there are lines in the concurrence that go down that path. The majority went much further than that.
I want to note two small things. One, it is funny and infuriating to me how every solution for the justices come up with, liberal or conservative, is that the judges should decide. That even in the case of Congress, even in the case, the world that they imagine where Congress would pass something, the court is still saying, oh, we would review it. Congress decides to disqualify somebody, passes a law disqualifying somebody or passes something disqualifying somebody. We would review it. We would decide. I mean, and even the liberal view seems to be, oh, this can happen via court challenge. And we would decide that. So they love to grab power, these black-robed justices.
Yeah, there's a lot of judicial supremacy subtext here, for sure.
Can I go back just quickly and to ask why it's so wrong to say to Congress, you figure this out? I mean, I get some of the reasons why it's wrong, but in like the abstract, let's imagine that Congress is functioning. Let's imagine, you know, right. I mean, obviously, but I mean, the Supreme Court, obviously they've made a political decision here. So you can't say like the Supreme Court can't make decisions that bend to the fact that we have a dysfunctional Congress, but they made decisions that bend the fact that we have this particular political moment. So I get it. But imagining for a moment we were just in class or we just had the founders in front of us, what would the principles of the government as it should work argue against giving Congress power? Some people would say, well, they already have the power that's in the 14th Amendment. But imagine you didn't think that was the case. What would be wrong with saying to Congress, you have to determine what an insurrection is and put this in some sort of legislative language?
I mean, I think it's just the cumbersome nature of Congress actually doing that, the mechanism of forcing action, right? When something is self-executing, then you're just saying you want it to be there instantly. One piece of evidence, obviously, that this is what Congress had in mind at the time was that they put in a way to remove what they called the disability, right? They said by a two-thirds vote, we can let someone in. So they're obviously were putting the onus on the insurrectionists to prove that they were not insurrectionists, right? Like, it's all about what the default is.
That to me is the most puzzling, which is
it
like,
is. Well, yes.
if Congress took the time to take off the disability,
yes,
where did they think the disability was going to come on? And if they thought it was their job to put the disability on, wouldn't they have said so?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yep. Yep.
If in fact your reading of this is right, Emily, how do you think the justices all like whistle past the shabbiness of this? What do they tell themselves when they're trying to fall asleep at night?
I mean, isn't it? This is where I get to. It's the least bad. Sorry, you asked Emily. The least bad outcome. They didn't want to rule that Trump wasn't an insurrectionist, nor did they want to rule that Trump wasn't an officer of the United States. Both of those seem manifestly stupid. Nor did they want to create this patchwork of rules or patchwork of different ballots. So it feels to me like they found this is the least bad way for us to get to. And they grabbed at this, what was it, this decision that what's his name made as a circuit court judge back, Salmon P. Chase made, and just were like, oh yeah, that's what they all meant.
Right. I mean, there were other off ramps that I think would have been more technicalities and caused less damage. in terms of future uses of this amendment. So I resent that part of their decision making. But yes, and also when you have nine people agreeing on the outcome, how bad is everybody sleeping? Like, they're having a fight, but it's a fight about the extent of the decision, not about the basic logic of it. I do have to mention one more thing, which is Justice Amy Coney Barrett tone policing the liberals for what she called stridency. She wants everyone marching down the road toward American sunset in unison. I found it super irritating, and I appreciated on Strict Scrutiny, a podcast about the Supreme Court, the comparison of Barrett to Dolores Umbridge, which I think came from Leah Littman, one of the Strict Scrutiny trios. I thought that was perfect.
Okay, we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Hey, everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024, The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
We're joined by Frank Foer, the author of a new Atlantic cover story, The Golden Age of American Jews is Ending. There are many jokes to make here about the Golden Age of American Jews has already ended. Like at my bar mitzvah, I feel like that was probably, it was over by then. Or ended, Frank, when you were bounced as the editor of the New Republic. That is another moment you could have marked as the Golden Age of American Jews ending. But you are arguing, well, we'll explain more, but you're arguing that the Gaza war has accelerated an anti-Zionist streak in the progressive left that has kind of tipped over into anti-Semitism. And you also say that we're at sort of the end of a great 70-year run in American life where Jews had advocated and benefited from the best American values, the expansion of civil rights, the meritocracy, expansive government, strong public education systems, and that whole system is eroding in part because of a rising anti-Semitism, or that's a piece of it. And with it goes the secure and prosperous place of Jews in America. That is a quick categorization of your article. Maybe you want to correct it. But can I start with a really, really skeptical question, which is, as I read this, so this is a moment when American Jews are richer and better educated and more prosperous than any group of Jews has ever been in the history of the world. And when there is a huge amount of inequality and suffering in America that is overwhelmingly not happening to Jews. And so is this really the moment to frame the problems in America through the lens of a kind of golden age of American Judaism ending?
Every golden age ends in a precipitous sort of way where Jews feel like they're sitting on top and that they have this unprecedented wealth, security, sense of cultural influence, and then things tend to go kablooey. So there's a historical pattern that I think justifies that type of the type of alarmism that my piece exudes. And then the other thing is that the rise of anti-Semitism, I think, is very intimately connected to problems of democratic decay. So it's not just that the world should be worried that Jews aren't getting into Harvard and Yale at the same rates that they did 10 years ago. That seems to me like a pretty immaterial and marginal fact, although it is something that a lot of Jews consider to be a significant marker of their own decline in American culture. But the rise of hateful speech, of vandalism, of harassment, all these things that have been percolating up over time have exploded. And I think that to me is symptomatic of a society that's not great at being able to mediate differences of political opinion. It's emblematic to me of a society where conspiracy theories start to run rampant and where there's mistrust. And it's also emblematic to me of the way in which demagoguery has taken hold on both sides of the political spectrum.
So one thing I was wrestling with a lot as I was reading this, I was identifying closely with parts of it. I was trying to resist some of the alarmism because I think for reasons similar to David's, I worry about like overemphasizing anti-Semitism. And in fact, you gesture at this in the piece as well. And then I keep coming back to this question about Israel, which is that, you know, I absolutely see why you're arguing that Israel has gone from being a kind of asset in Jewish American identity to a deficit. And then the problem is how much Israel has, of the government has, this Bibi Netanyahu's government in particular, has contributed to that and forced that to happen. And this kind of conundrum that, you know, for American Jews who want the state of Israel to continue to exist and who resent that Israel is the only country anybody ever talks about disestablishing, you still have this problem of occupation that the Gaza war has obviously fueled, and that in the West Bank is continuing in its own kind of merciless way. And I just get a little stuck here, right? It's like Israel is singled out. It's held to a higher standard. It's a source of resentment in a way that lots of countries that do terrible things is not. And yet it is also culpable. For some American Jews, there's this defensiveness about Israel, which I understand. And for others, there's a sense of blame. Like, you are making things worse for us. How are you thinking about all those things?
Yeah, it's funny. One of the reactions that I've heard from a lot of American Jews to my piece is they blame Israel for making conditions worse for American Jewry. And they're thinking about fleeing to Israel and making aliyah because conditions have become so intolerable in the United States, or they worry about it becoming so intolerable in the United States. And so the way that I think about it is that This is all symptomatic of a very unhealthy way that the world thinks about Jews and thinks about Israel. That nobody blames the genocide, you know, the genocide of the Uyghurs on Chinese Americans. You know, China has a pretty good claim to being a settler colonial state in large measure, and nobody talks about it in that sort of way in mainstream discourse. There's only one country that gets spoken about in that sort of way. And I think the more normal way to be able to think about this is that people should be able to criticize the hell out of Israel and say that they're, you know, say that they're doing, that the war in Gaza is merciless in the way that you describe, without it having to resort to an accusation of a conspiracy in the United States that is exerting all this control over our media, over our universities, And it's the way in which Zionism emerges as this kind of word where you can just see the flecks of spittle kind of coming off of people's mouths when they talk about it. And it's just dripping with disdain. And then it clearly becomes a synonym for Jews. And it repeats all of these historic accusations leveled against Jews for being greedy, conniving, bloodthirsty, etc.
It's easier to be anti-Ukraine funding than it is anti-Israel funding. And if there was this easy to touch anti-Semitism, not if, there obviously is. But given that there's this easy to touch, it's now kind of more okay to flirt with anti-Semitism. I guess I'm wondering why that hasn't bled into a we don't need to support Israel. This whole thing's a mess. Like, why do we even have to bother with it? Like that doesn't seem to have really happen at the political level.
I mean, except that I think the administration thought you could attach Israel aid to Ukraine aid and suddenly it would unlock the problem. And that wasn't able to actually break the logjam there. Why? I mean, I think that Israel still has broad support. And just to say that anti-Semitism is emerging doesn't mean that anti-Semitism has become a majority position at all. The majority position is still very favorable to Jews, very favorable to Israel. But in order for anti-Semitism to be a meaningful fact in American life, if one in five college students at selective colleges says they don't want to be friends with people who are pro-Israel, it suddenly, you know, that's to me a meaningful number. And in terms of creating a sense of anxiety and insecurity, if you start to see anti-Semitism in places that feel very local, it starts to trigger anxieties. Like, I walked down to the foot of my street the other morning and I saw spray painted on a box KKK IDF. And I'm like, wait a second. Like, you could say what you want about the IDF, like in that they've done terrible things, but they're not the Ku Klux Klan. And my neighbor was walking down the street on Connecticut Avenue, and somebody shouted at her, you know, F the Kikes. And it's like, it takes a couple of local incidents like that to make it this problem feel very, very close to home, even if it isn't. I don't walk around the streets thinking like everybody is an anti-Semite, every Gentile is an anti-Semite at all, because I know that that's not the case.
I live in the same neighborhood as you, Frank, and our bridge has been defaced with sort of from the river to the sea, and there are Palestinian flags on it. I guess I just, I'm not a descendant of Holocaust survivors. I'm a descendant of people who came to America because they wanted to come to America, not because they had to flee somewhere. And maybe I'm not paranoid, but I think I worry, like, if you look at what happened in France over the past 20 years, a huge number of French Jews have left France and gone to Israel because they, in the wake of what they felt was legitimately felt was rising anti-Semitism in France, fueled in part by a lot of Muslim immigration. And this has made Israel more French and has made France a lot less Jewish. And I would say that is not a great outcome for France. And I think the notion that this is a moment to flee, or this is a moment where people should think about fleeing, is a troubling one to me. And I guess I don't feel like that we're anywhere near there. And to, as you do in the piece, to sort of invoke the Central Union of German Citizens of the Jewish Faith publishing their 1,000 page book in 1933, talking about the achievements of their community is creating an alarmism that isn't merited by the actual moment.
I don't think that American Jews should flee. I'm not fleeing. But I think you do hear this conversation happening among American Jewry, and I can't not note that's occurring right now. And I think that part of sounding the alarm is about trying to shock people into addressing something that is, it's kind of very fast slipping in dangerous directions. That I keep hearing, you know, the Bay Area is a central narrative in my piece, and I keep hearing stories that make me think I undersold what was happening there. Somebody sent me a piece yesterday about the head of an art center in San Francisco, where basically everybody started to disrupt the art center. Palestinian protesters would disrupt everything that was happening in this art center, demanding that the organization take a stand on the war. And then the Jewish head of the art center ended up getting purged from the board because they were purging all of the Zionists from the organization. And artists were insisting that every artist kind of nod in the direction of Palestine. There's something so deeply unhealthy when, you know, I'm not saying that Israel's war in Gaza can't be criticized, or, you know, there's a lot of problems with it. I have a lot of problems with the way that they've conducted the war. And I think that allowing the people of Gaza to starve is inhumane. But I don't think that American Jews in San Francisco, who have nothing to do with that, should be forced out of organizations or treated as toxic characters because of what Israel is doing. And there's something sick about our political culture if that's the way it behaves.
Yeah. I mean, I also have been thinking a lot about this and worrying about this. And part of, I wonder if this framing makes sense to you. I have been feeling, including in my own community, that it's still okay to be Jewish, but the only way that you're allowed to be Jewish is to be an anti-Zionist, that you have to profess that. And then it's fine, because the people who are, assuming that, you know, Israel is evil and should never
in the left.
Yes, in my world.
That is not true in overwhelming swaths of America.
On college campuses,
it's true.
I live in a college town.
You look at, but that is I mean, it's, you can't just discount college campuses as being insignificant.
Okay, but no, but you, it's, Emily, but, it's, but it's, no, it was a categorical statement. The only way to be Jewish is to be anti-Zionist. I just don't.
I started the statement, David, by talking about how I was feeling this in my own community. I wasn't trying to make a categorical statement about all of America. I'm talking about.
I apologize
about,
if I missed that. Okay. I missed that.
I'm talking about.
I'm just happy to not be a part of a semantic debate that I'm not taking part in.
Or a Semitic debate.
Yes, I'm pro-Semitic and pro-Semitic.
I'm going to continue. That is a real shift. I have never felt that way before. Now, I don't, you know, there's, it's not like anti-Semitism didn't exist, et cetera. But in my particular world, this feels present, this idea that there is one way to be Jewish in progressive world. And it is not the way that I want to be Jewish right now. And it is really unsettling. And a lot of the reporting that you were doing in Berkeley, which was like a much, you know, more disturbing version of these feelings I've had, resonated because of that. And there is something to me really troubling about the idea of other people telling me what my ethnic and peoplehood and religious identity is supposed to consist of. I don't do that to other people.
Or I just see this happening in other places where, you know, I have a friend whose 12-year-old daughter was walking on the Upper West Side, no discernible Jewish markers on her, gets stopped by somebody who says, "What's your position on the Gaza war?" You know, 12-year-old girl. And I hear this in Berkeley, in San Francisco, where people, if you wear a yarmulke, it's different, David, I think is another thing that should be noted. That if you're, you know, it's hard to, you know, David Plotz, I guess, is kind of unmistakable in his own right. But
yeah, I really
passing isn't working for him.
If you wear a yarmulke, you become, you become this canvas onto which people splatter all sorts of things that make you uniquely vulnerable. And the polling on college campuses is astronomical. That you have, I think it's about 60%, maybe even higher now, of Jewish college students say that they fear that they pay a social price for being Jewish, and the result of that is inevitably going to be suppression of identity, or to a turn to kind of do the pressure to do the politically correct thing.
I have one more sort of observation that I want to try out on you that actually comes from one of my kids. He was pointing out that Jews are very unusual in that they have been a very tiny percentage of the world's population and they remain the same tiny percentage. So I think there were like 14 million Jews or so before the Holocaust, and now there are around 14 or 15 million. Like, that's really weird. He was arguing that, like, demographically, usually with a group, either groups become, they just go away because they don't grow, or they grow, you know, exponentially over time, because that's what happens with population. And that has not happened with Jews. There is this like tininess, while there is also this perception of outsized power that have coexisted now for a century. And I wonder if that's part of our dilemma.
I mean, it's coexisted, I would say, probably through all time, where Jews have never been a demographically significant group relative to the whole. They've always been a minority, and they've always been accused of wielding outsized power. That is like the definition of anti-Semitism.
There is no doubt that you will have many things to talk about if you read Frank's cover story in The Atlantic. The golden age of American Jews is ending. It is so provocative and so interesting. And obviously you can tell from the passionate feelings invoked here that it's a great tool for discussion. So, Frank, thank you.
Thank you.
See you on the bridge.
See you on the bridge.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are having a kosher cocktail of some sort, Emily, as a Jew in a rapidly declining America for Jews, what are you going to be elegiacally chattering about?
Last week, I was distressed about some criminal justice draconian changes in Louisiana, which in fact became law. This week in the election, there was some better news in terms of continuing some sort of path toward punishing people in less harsh ways, which was that the progressive candidates for district attorney won in Houston and in Austin, and George Gascon, the DA in LA, is making it to a runoff. And, you know, if you're someone who thinks that our system is still locking up too many people, those are positive developments. And I also have to give a shout out to a diversion program for first-time gun possession offenders in Philadelphia, which has gotten a ton of good press, a piece I really liked in The Trace by Mensa Dean about it. And I'm slightly bashful about this because my sister Dana helped design this program and gets a lot of credit for it. But it's a really interesting program that's having success with people in terms of they have a much lower reoffending rate than people who are not going through the program. And one of the impetuses for it is that the people who get caught and criminally charged for gun possession, just possession, not hurting anyone, are way, way disproportionately Black in Philadelphia. And so that is part of the concern here is trying to give people other ways to think about their lives so that they're not committing new crimes.
John, what's your chatter?
I don't know much about NASCAR. I wish I knew more. But one thing intrigued me from the world of NASCAR this week was that
NASCAR is Joey super boring. It's really, there's a period I learned a lot about it, really tedious, but go ahead.
Well, Joey Logano, who is a auto racing champion, was dinged for cheating. And he was dinged for cheating by wearing a glove. And you might think, well, wouldn't you normally cheat with like the weight of your car and maybe like you put some sticky stuff on the tires or something? No, what the reason that he was dinged for cheating is basically apparently when you're going zooming in a NASCAR, there's lots of wind or some amount of wind comes in through the netting and the window. And that if you can block the wind that comes in, you can pick up a mile or, you know, you can go a mile an hour faster or 2 miles an hour faster. So race car drivers hold up their hand to try to basically block the wind as they're zooming. And so he had this glove that had some webbing in it that that apparently made it easier for him to do that. And so this is something I did not know, but they fined him $10,000 and I think he might also have gotten some points taken away or something else in some other fashion. But apparently also it's dangerous, which is because if you get in an accident or something, like having this funky glove on your hand might make it difficult to get out of the car.
My chatter, I have the most enthusiastic TV endorsement I've had in a while. My girlfriend and I have been watching a show called One Day on Netflix. Do you guys know this? There was a book, there was a movie of it too. It looks at two young British people who meet on the last day of university on July 15th, 1988 or 1989. Can't remember which. And then it revisits them on July 15th for years to come. And so each episode is one July 15th. And it's basically stars these two actors who they are 95% of the action, a young man named Leo Woodall and a young woman named Ambika Maud. And they are so good. And the story is so lovely and emotionally nuanced and tense, and I have no idea where it's going. And they are, it's just beautifully written. It's beautifully acted. It is nothing happens as far as I can tell, but nothing happens in an utterly transfixing way. If you like the show Normal People, if you like that book or that series, it's a little bit like Normal People, but not quite as dark. And it's more English than Irish, or it's entirely English rather than being Irish. And it's just glorious.
I would like to be a normal person.
Someday, John.
Someday. We're watching Shogun, which is enjoyable.
Oh, that's on my list. Can't wait for that. I actually just also want to do one other quick second chatter, by the way, which is that there's a solar eclipse coming up. It's sweeping up from the southwest to the northeast. And I'm going to be going actually to Vermont to try to see it, although there'll probably be cloud cover. And a full solar eclipse is one of the marvels of the universe. And my old friends and colleagues at Atlas Obscura are doing an eclipse festival in Hot Springs, Arkansas for the eclipse, which is in early April. They have an amazing lineup of speakers, of music, of events. We did an eclipse festival for the Great American Solar Eclipse of 2017 in Oregon, and it was one of the highlights of my life. So I expect that the Atlas Obscura Eclipse Festival in Hot Springs will be another such highlight. And you can see that at atlasobscura.com/eclipse.
Where is that the best place to go see it? Hot Springs?
It's one of the really good places because it's unlikely to be cloudy. that's where you want to be, is somewhere it's not likely to be cloudy.
Right. What if you're in like downtown New York?
It doesn't go over downtown New York, so that's a bad place to be.
But the buildings eclipse it, so it's fine.
Listeners, you also have chattered. Oh, how you chattered. You emailed your chatters to gabfest@slate.com. Oh, my. And our cocktail chatter this week comes from Jason in San Francisco. And this was the one which I teased last week, which we almost did as a Slate Plus segment. But instead, we've got Jason talking about this wonderful, amazing historical art episode. Please send us your chatter at gabfest@slate.com and listen to Jason right now.
Hello, GabFest. This is Jason DeWeese in San Francisco. My chatter is a story in the San Francisco Standard. The intrigue starts with the subhead, "A martyred Russian artist had been dead for 81 years. Then his life's work turned up one morning in a Bayside park." Reporter Julie Zagoras recounts the story of a city employee who finds 48 pieces of art carefully arranged on a bench at Crane Cove Park in San Francisco. The story takes us to Paris before World War II and uncovers a lost Jewish artist named Ari Arkady Lashkov, a contemporary of Chagall and Picasso, who died of malnutrition under Nazi occupation in 1941, and whose sole known surviving painting was in private hands in Paris. Who was Lashkov and who left this, the largest collection of his work, on a San Francisco park bench on a sunny May day in 2022?
That's our show for today. The GabFest is produced by Shayna Roth. Our researcher is Julie Hugin. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Ops. And Alicia Montgomery is VP of Audio for Slate. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We will talk to you next week. And please join us in Washington on March 27th at the Hamilton for our live show. Tickets are at slate.com/GabFest Live. Slate.com/GabFest Live. Bye-bye. Hi, Slate Plus. How are you? So we had a really interesting Slate Plus teed up, but then we had a more interesting Slate Plus that appeared to us as if in a vision, as if a blessing from above, and that blessing from above is our researcher, Julie Hugin. Julie is many things in life, but among the things she is an election worker in Colorado, which is called an election judge. She's called an election judge, and she's been doing that for several years. And every now and then, when there's an election coming up or an election day happens, she comes and sort of tells us a little anecdote about what's happening in the election. And she was doing that today, talking about what happened on Super Tuesday. And we were so interested, and it was such an interesting conversation, that we said, hey, can we talk about this? Are you allowed to talk about this on the GabFest? And she said, yes. So Julie, welcome. I don't know. Have you been on air yet?
I have not been on air yet. This is exciting.
Welcome. Double treat.
She's got a few things she wants to get off her chest before we get to the topic.
Just start by telling us, what's your job in election work and how did you get it?
So for election judges in Colorado, you basically work for the county that you're in Colorado. So we're all, I guess, really working for the clerk of the county in which we live here in Colorado. And the election judges do a variety of jobs. So a lot of them work inside what here in Arapahoe County, Colorado, we refer to as the warehouse because all ballots go to the warehouse. And that's where they're all, the envelopes are all opened, the ballots are counted, and the ballots are stored. For, I believe it's a 14-year period, they have to be stored. Every single ballot that the county has received for every election, because of basically Freedom of Information Act reasons, they have to keep all of the physical ballots there. And then election judges are spread out across a county. We work in voter service and polling centers to help folks. We are the people who collect the ballots from the drop-off ballot boxes. And in this particular Super Tuesday election, I was working a drop-off ballot box. So basically, as people drove through, We were just helping them, saving them the effort of getting out of their car to drop it in the box. And we just were the middle guy moving it from their car.
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.